About the development of the English Bible. And I think it's important for us that we've touched on this a little bit before, but I think it's important for us to hit it again so that we kind of understand the development of English over the course of time. When we're talking about Old English, when we're talking about Middle English, we're not talking about modern English as we have it today. Old English was a Low German dialect. Would have a lot more in common with other German dialects at the time. In fact, it would not be particularly understandable to us today. And it is something that lasted all the way through about the year 1066. Before that time, you had several different Germanic tribes that had settled in the eastern three quarters of Great Britain. And those people were generally the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes. Some people say there were also Frisians that were part of that group of people. And all of those had come from the lower part of Denmark, the northern part of Germany, and the northern part of Holland, and had come across the sea after the Romans had withdrawn their troops from Great Britain and had settled in those areas that now were under-inhabited. Those people, as they began to intermingle with one another, began to develop a language that was called Anglo-Saxon. The Angles were one of the tribes. We got our word English from Angles. The Saxons were one of those tribes, but there were other tribes involved in that too. And the dialects they spoke were quite similar. In fact, mutually intelligible. But there was also, in any kind of situation where people are speaking different dialects or different language, a level of misunderstanding that takes place in there. And English, at that point, already was beginning to make some changes. One of those changes is to change from a highly inflected language to one that did not show much inflection. Inflected languages are those that you have nouns and pronouns change their endings depending on how the word is used in a sentence. You see that in Greek. If you've studied Latin, you see how that works commonly. There aren't many inflections left in modern English, but one of the ones that we do have is we do change depending on whether we're talking about something being in the genitive in English. Generally, we'll say if something belongs to Bob, it is Bob's rather than or of Bob. And in the old days, they would have different kinds of inflections for every way that a word could be used in a sentence, from nominative, genitive, ablative, locative, instrumental, dative, accusative, vocative, all kinds of forms that I don't need to explain to you today. But any way that a word could be used in a sentence, there generally was a different ending to it. When you have people who speak nearly the same language together, and you have them speaking languages that have different inflections, though, the easiest thing to abandon is the inflections. And so people began to use prepositions instead of inflections at the end of words, in to make things easier and to make the communication a little bit better. So Old English, that was several different dialects, kind of melds toward the end of the first millennium into a language that's usually referred to as Old English or Anglo-Saxon. In about the year 793, you began to have Viking invasions that were talked about a little bit. And the Vikings also were a Germanic people. Their languages weren't quite as related as the German dialects that were spoken by the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes, but the Danes and the Norsemen spoke Germanic languages that also to some extent were mutually intelligible to those who spoke Anglo-Saxon. But again, the problem was the inflections. And as you began to have the Danes, who were settled pretty extensively in what became the Danelaw, which was the area of northern and eastern England, they began to, again, have their languages meld to some extent. And almost every word that we have that has a sk sound in it is one that we got from the Vikings. The word sky. There were words that were quite similar. This right here that I'm wearing, the Angles and the Saxons called it a shirt. The Vikings called it a skirt. And we develop two words for things because we don't call what I'm wearing now a skirt. We call what a woman wears that goes down and covers her legs as being a skirt. And we call this a shirt. We call the Angles and the Saxons had a boat that they called a skiff. And the Vikings had boats that they called skips, ships. The words are quite similar. You can tell they were trying to have the same thing. And what we've done is we've incorporated both words into our language, and they have different connotations. We'll talk about a skiff as being a small boat and a ship as being a larger boat. That's not necessarily the distinction that the Vikings and the Anglo-Saxons made, but it is one that as the languages began to meld, you began to have use words that they had in common similarly. In 1066, however, you had the Norman invasion of England. And the Normans were a group of people who were Vikings who had been settled in about the year 911 at the area around the mouth of the Seine River in France. The Vikings had been raiding France for a number of years by the early 900s. And finally, they had a king in France that said, listen, I'm tired of this. What I need to do is I need to hire one of these groups. I'll give them land and let them be the Dukes of Normandy. But what they'll have to do is they'll have to fight all other Vikings that would come in there. They'll protect the mouth of the Seine, and the Seine River led all the way to Paris, which was his capital. If they're fighting and they're defending my capital, then I don't have to worry about other Vikings. And what happened with that was, is the Dukes of Normandy became at many times as powerful or even more powerful than the King of France. It was one of those Dukes of Normandy who was related to the king, Edward the Confessor in England, who was an Anglo-Saxon king, and he didn't have any children. And through several different things that would be an interesting story, but not really within our purview, you had Edward the Confessor promising the throne to two different people. One was to Harold Godwinson, and who was an Anglo-Saxon, and the other to William of Normandy. And when he died in the first part of 1066, the one who was on hand was Harold Godwinson, who became Harold II of England. And yet this made William of Normandy mad, and so he began to mount an invasion. The invasion took place in the fall of 1066, and at the Battle of Hastings, Harold Godwinson was shot in the eye with an arrow that killed him, and therefore his claim to the throne was moot, and William the Conqueror, as he was called, became King of England as well as Duke of Normandy. So the most powerful duke in France, as well as the king of England. Now, these Normans were people, as I mentioned, who had been Vikings in the early 900s, and probably as for 100 years, they would even have Norse-speaking shamans and storytellers in their courts. But by the year 1066, they didn't speak Norse anymore. They spoke French because they lived in France and they were French dukes. All of the men that had come with William the Conqueror were French speakers. While all of them weren't necessarily Normans, he had gathered people from all over France and Flanders and other places like that throughout that part of Europe. But all of them were French speakers. When they conquered England, they immediately changed everything in England and basically took the land away from those Anglo-Saxon nobles and gave it to Norman nobles. So what that did immediately was it put a French-speaking military elite in charge of the land in England, put a French-speaking king in charge of England, and it was that way for a third of a millennium. It's not until 1400, after that 1066, it's a long ways to 1400, that you wind up having an English-speaking king in England again. All their other kings didn't speak English, they just spoke French. And the rulers and the nobles that were in England spoke French, and the common people spoke Anglo-Saxon. Over that third of a millennium, those languages began to meld. And it is one of the reasons why the unabridged English dictionary is the most extensive dictionary in the world. In fact, the second biggest dictionary in the world, unabridged dictionary, is the German language, is the dictionary of the German language, and it is less than half as large as the English unabridged dictionary. There are over twice as many words in English as there are in German, and German has more words in it than any other language except English. One of the reasons for that is because, like I said, when we were talking about it before, there had been so many times in which you'd had English adapt to other people. We had, for many words, not only a German word, but a Norse word that we used both of them and gave them slightly different connotations. The same thing wound up happening in terms of French. You didn't know that you spoke French, but you basically do speak a form of French. And usually, when we are just having a conversation with one another, we use almost all German words. When we are speaking to the teacher, or when someone is giving a speech, or when you are reading in the newspaper, most of the words that you're reading there are words that we got from either Latin or French. And the reason is because you have those words that were used by the nobility being Latin-based words from the French language, and the words that the common people spoke were German-based words for the commoner. And here's the way we develop two words, for example. Let's just suppose that you had an Anglo-Saxon servant who worked out in the field, and you wanted him to take care of your sheep and your pigs and your cows. You would talk to him. He would communicate to you about what he had, and he would talk about having a coo, a cow. We have a word that we get from that. Schaf, sheep, and a Schwein, swine. You know, we have words that we still use that are based on those German words. The French would talk about having not a Schaf, but a mouton. And we have a word that's kind of like mouton. What do you eat at the table? Mutton. You don't eat Schwein. You eat, the French word for pig was porc. So in the field, it's swine. On your table, it is what? It is pork. So in examples like that, we develop two different kind of connotations for many different things. You know, the word cow. We still use the word cow, but on the table when we eat it, it is beef. And the word in French for this was bœuf. So here, generally, when the Germans were talking to one another about what they did out in the field or in the pasture, they'd use those German words. When they talked about what they were providing for their nobles, they would use the French words for that. Even in our language today, there are words in English that were perfectly good words for, what shall we say, common or private activities that were perfectly good German words. But we generally consider those words to be nasty, because they were Anglo-Saxon rather than French. It was considered low class to use those particular kinds of words rather than use the words that are based on French or Latin base rather than the ones that were Anglo-Saxon and German. In about 1066, through about the next 200 or 300 years, the language that develops is Middle English. And I gave you a little recitation back several class periods ago of what Middle English sounded like. You could probably piece out a little bit, if you were looking at it on a page, what Middle English was trying to say. But still, it would not fall to our ears very well. You know, the beginning of Canterbury Tales, you know, one that operated with its persit de rota, when April with its sweet showers, the drought of March has pierced to the root. If you knew that's what I was saying, if you knew I was speaking in poetic language, and you strained a little bit, you might be able to piece together what I was trying to say. But that is Middle English. And it's not really until we get close to the King James period that we get into what is modern English. The reason I'm telling you about Middle English is because it is in that Middle English period that we begin to see the first Bible in Middle English, and it was translated by a man named John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe was a very interesting kind of person. He lived in the 1300s, died in 1384. He was a priest, he was a scholar, he was a teacher, he was a philosopher, he was a translator. And he made it his life's work to basically try to reform the Catholic Church. And some have described him as being kind of the morning star of the Reformation, because the Reformation wouldn't take place for another 175 or 200 years after he died. But he was someone who was beginning to criticize the Roman Catholic Church and tell people what we need to follow is what the Bible has to say, rather than just what the Roman Catholic Church tells us. He criticized the wealth of the Roman Catholic Church, especially when you compared it to the poverty of people who it was gaining its wealth from. He would criticize the wealth of the priesthood, which at that time was pretty predatory in many places in England. And so he was kind of a pre-Reformation reformer. One of the things that the people questioned him about was, how can we follow the Bible and it be our main standard rather than the Catholic Church and the traditions of the church if we don't know about the Bible? So he began to translate it, and he translated the New Testament. He may have translated the whole of the New Testament by himself. We know he at least translated Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts. He may have translated the entire New Testament. A friend of his named Nicholas of Hereford translated the Old Testament. Now, what they're translating it from is not Greek and Hebrew, which are the original language. They're translating it from the Vulgate. So they're making an English translation from a Latin translation of the Greek and the Hebrew Old Testament and New Testament. So anytime you have a translation of a translation, you're allowing for some inaccuracy. Do you understand what I'm saying? Have you ever played that game where you have a long line of people sitting around in a kind of semicircle, and one person begins by telling a secret in the ear of the first one, and then they tell that secret all the way down the line, and it goes down to the end, and you ask the person on the end what it was, and see if it has any relation to what the person said at the beginning? Very often they don't really match very well, do they? Because it has been changed ever so slightly every time that you've had someone else have to express that idea in their own words. Anytime you're cutting out a pattern, ladies, to make a dress, You have to, as inconvenient as it is, you have to wind up unpinning the pattern every time for the material. Let's say you wanted to make 10 dresses instead of just one, and all the gals happen to be the same size. What you would have to do is you would have to unpin the pattern from the cloth after you had cut it out and put it on another piece of cloth and cut it out, because you can't just say, well, I'll put all these cloths right here and I'll just use one pattern and I'll cut it out, because every one that you cut is going to be slightly different than the other one. And that's the problem with translating from a translation. But not knowing Hebrew and not knowing Greek like Wycliffe was not able to do, and not having good access to texts in those languages, he did the best that he could to get something into the hands of English-speaking people. This was published in 1382. He dies in 1384. In 1388, Wycliffe's protege named John Purvey, he revises the entire Old and New Testament into what we generally think of as the Wycliffe Bible. And Wycliffe certainly was the guiding star behind it, but basically was only responsible for the initial rendering of the New Testament. But in it, we see for the first time people having the Bible in the English language. And that made a big difference, because if somebody was an educated person, they would have gone to Latin school or grammar school. The reason it was called grammar school is because you learned Latin grammar. And most educated people could read Latin. But there were many people who now were only beginning to be educated in the vernacular rather than in the Latin language. And being able to have it in a language that they could read, that they could sound out the words, and it made sense in the language that they were born with. It's always better to talk to someone about the Bible in a language and in speech patterns that are the ones that they grew up with, that they were most used to. And that's something that is the great thing about the Wycliffe translation of the Bible, that was able to do great things for them and be able to provide them. Will you advance that for me, please? I've already gone there. He was the morning star of the Reformation. Okay, after his death, his followers were called Lollards, which just means mumblers. You can tell if somebody's called you a Lollard, you probably wouldn't think they were trying to say something nice about you, would you? And they weren't trying to say nice things about John Wycliffe's followers. But I'll tell you, one thing about those Lollards is they were people who criticized the church traditions, and they adhered to the criticism that was made in the preface of the Wycliffe Bible. The Bible was eventually banned, and 44 years after Wycliffe's death, he was excommunicated. Now, I tell you, it really hurts you when they excommunicate you after you're dead. But what can you do to a fellow that you've excommunicated? What they do, 44 years after he died, they dug up his bones and burned them and threw them in the Thames River. As bad as the Catholic Church could do to him, but his teaching, criticizing the Roman Catholic Church, emphasizing the reading of the Bible, was something that was advanced far beyond his lifetime, and he was a very important person in the production of the English Bible. Sam?
But the content was still the same from King James to Wycliffe all the way back to, 300? Book, chapter, verse was still consistent. It's the translations are different.
Right. And translations vary from in terms of their quality. King James Version was one of the classic translations of all time, but there are certain things about it that aren't particularly good translations today. On one occasion, when I can't remember the citation right now, when it says, when it is talking about Passover in the original language, it uses the word Easter in the King James Version. Is that a good translation? No, because they weren't trying to get someplace by Easter. They were trying to get someplace by Passover. Sometimes words change meaning slightly. And the more, several years ago, there was the Jerusalem Bible that came out in English. It was a translation from a French translation of the Bible. The French translation, called the Bible Jerusalem, was translated from Greek and Hebrew. But it was translated into French. The American Jerusalem Bible was translated directly from the French. There's always a problem when you have that unnecessary middleman in there doing the translation. It's always best to go back to the original to make sure that there is not inaccuracy in what you are doing. I've heard people say, well, now listen, you can't put your confidence in the Bible because it's been translated and retranslated and retranslated. Let me tell you, that's a false argument. Because it doesn't make any difference how many times it's been translated if every time you go back to the originals. Do you see? That is the original is exactly what the Holy Spirit wanted said. And yet, if you translate from a translation, from a translation, from a translation, from a translation, that would very likely cause the problem that some people suggest. But it is really not a problem that usually exists. Any other questions? Did I see another hand up a minute ago? Advance that one more time, please. By 14:8, it had become illegal to translate or read the Bible into common English without the permission of a bishop. How often do you think they got permission from the bishop to read the Bible? Not very often. Because, why do you think the Catholic Church didn't want people reading the Bible? Wouldn't have been able to control them. And they would have, and I think perhaps the idea that Matt's talking about is too, that here is a function that we perform that would not necessarily be as necessary if we, it's power and influence there. If you have people starting to think on their own, it becomes a problem. You can't control them quite as easy. I remember when my son Jesse was just a little fellow. We'd give them an allowance, and part of the allowance we'd tell them they could spend immediately. Part of their allowance they had to save. Part of their allowance they had to give in the collection plate. Jesse has gotten to be a very good money manager. He's a disciple of Dave Ramsey, and he saves money, does a real good job. If he doesn't have the money for it, he doesn't buy it. When he was a little boy, that's not the way he thought. And he was always wanting to buy something that was one of those little toys that every parent knows. Their kid comes to him and wants to buy something that you can tell by looking at it, it's going to be broke the first day. You know what I'm talking about? Mary Ann would say, don't let him buy it. I'd say, no, we're trying to teach him something. Let's talk to him about it. And I'd say, son, listen, I want to teach you about value. You know, here, if now you have a dollar, if you buy this toy for a dollar, then you don't have the dollar anymore. But you've got the toy. But if in the first day or two you break the toy, now you don't have the dollar, and you don't have a toy that's worth playing with now either. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yes, sir. What are you going to do? I'm going to buy the toy. See? When you give people choices, there's always the choice they're going to choose different than what you want them to choose. Right? And I think that was the Catholic Church's problem. They were thinking about order. How are we going to, you know, no telling what kind of knucklehead will read something in the Bible and they'll think that's what they ought to do. This way we can control what is taught. That way we can control what we do. So I think there were certainly senses of power and control involved in it. But I think there was also a sense of order that was under consideration too. The thought, this is just going to confuse people because we in our culture have a lot more confidence in people's ability to reason than I think most people did in the Middle Ages. And that was one of the problems. You had it being outlawed to read the Bible, outlawed to translate the Bible unless you had the permission of a priest. Okay, turn to the next slide, please. I want to talk about the Spanish Bible for just a minute. Most of you don't speak Spanish or of Hispanic heritage, but it is important to understand that, especially since Spanish is spoken more as a first language in our world today than even English is. The only language that more people speak Mandarin Chinese and as a first language, and then Spanish, and then English is third. English is probably spoken more than all the rest of them because it is spoken as a second and third language more than Mandarin and Spanish are. But because of that, Spanish is really important, and how it got the Bible is also important for us to at least look at for just a minute. First major translation of the Bible into Spanish was the Alfonso Bible in 1280, and it was commissioned by Alfonso the Wise, who was the king of Castile. In the development of Spain, you basically had several different kingdoms had come together. And in the final analysis, there was the kingdom of Castile with its capital up in León and eventually at Madrid. And you had a kingdom of Aragon, which had its capital, had its largest city in Barcelona. It wasn't until 1492 that King Ferdinand of Aragon married Queen Isabella of Castile and united the two countries. So it became Spain rather than Castile and Aragon. The language that we call Spanish is even in the Spanish world today is generally not called Spanish. It's called Castellano, you know, because they'll say I speak Castilian rather than I speak Spanish. Now, that's not the case necessarily in North America or South America, but there are places in South America where you ask them what they speak, they'll say they speak Castellano. Because it is the language that was spoken in northern Spain, in north and western Spain, rather than northeastern Spain. And it was under Alfonso the Wise that you had a Spanish Bible produced in 1280. It was translated also, like the Wycliffe Bible, from the Latin Vulgate. And it was areas of it were not complete translations. There were parts of it that were abridged and parts of it that were paraphrased rather than exclusively translated. Turn to the next slide, please. In 1430, Rabbi Moses Arangel translated the Old Testament into Castilian. He was a Jew, and there were an awful lot of Jews in Spain at the time. They had settled there. In fact, another thing happened in 1492 when Castile and Aragon became the same country. What else happened in 1492? Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And another thing that happened is Isabel and Ferdinand expelled the Jews from Spain. Before that time, there were more Jews in Spain than any place else at the time. In fact, the cities of Cordoba in southern Spain, Sevilla in southern Spain, were towns that were Jewish towns to a large extent. Valencia on the eastern coast was a town that had an awful lot of Jewish people. In fact, what's interesting is after they had expelled Jews, they made them basically either convert to Catholicism or leave. And every time you have a situation like that, you have some people who will convert just for the convenience of it. But that began to bother some of the subsequent kings and queens of Spain. And so they said, what if we had these people who just were lying when they said they'd convert to Catholicism? So the Spanish Inquisition developed basically to try to weed out Protestants, to try to weed out Muslims, to try to weed out Jews who had converted to Catholicism but hadn't really converted on the inside. In the town of Valencia, even to this day, guess what women do on Saturday? They go out and they clean and they sweep the sidewalks and the porches of their houses. Very publicly. If you have a town that was primarily Jewish and they were being looked at in the Inquisition to make sure that they had truly converted, What difference do you think it would make what they did on Saturday? Exactly. What are these people, even to a tradition that probably people in Valencia have no idea why they do it to this day? But the reason that they continue to have this tradition is because you had people who had come from a Jewish background out there proving to people, yeah, see, I'm working on Saturday. It's not just because they like to have the sidewalks and the cobblestones and the porches clean. It was to prove that they weren't Jewish so that they could avoid the excesses of the Inquisition. Was something that this Old Testament translation that I mentioned in 1430 is today known as the Bible of the House of Alba, or the Alba Bible. And it was an illuminated manuscript, kind of like the ones that we saw Sean showing you on Sunday. It was very elaborate. It was had an awful lot of illustrations in it, and it was very important in that way. So Spain was probably the most important country in the world in the 14 and 1500s. We tend to think of things exclusively from an Anglo point of view. Spain was the most powerful country at the time of the exploration, and there was a time in which the King of Spain was also the Holy Roman Emperor and the most powerful man on earth. We talk about how the sun never set on the British Empire. During the 1500s, the sun never sat on the Spanish Empire, and it was a very important country, and it also was at least producing, not so much for the people, but at least for the priests that wanted to be able to have access to the Bible in their language. Turn to the next slide, please. We talked a little bit about the Gutenberg Press here a while back, and I think this is important, and this is one of the things that I think the Lord providentially allowed to occur right around the time when the Bible was first translated into English, and that is the press that was able to produce books because of movable type. We take that for granted, but in this day and time, to purchase a Bible would have been too expensive to be able to stand. A handwritten Bible would have been one that would have cost much more than anybody could buy. You might have a church that could buy one. You might have a very wealthy person that could have one. When they use movable type so that you could have hundreds of copies made of the Bible rather than just one in the same period of time, you had it to where the cost went down. Now, a Gutenberg Bible still cost a clerk about 3 years' wages. So imagine if you were a white-collar worker and it took 3 years' pay to buy a Bible. That's still something that most people don't have access to. But this Gutenberg Bible, which was a Latin, not a translation, but just, it was a Latin translation of the originals that was published for the first time. And here it was published by Johann Gutenberg. And this invention probably led to the spreading of written materials far beyond any scope that anybody could have imagined up to that time. The books that we have today are printed in that way. Now, we don't have to set movable type like that anymore. We can, through computers, do things much more simply than they did. It might take somebody a day or a day and a half to be able to set a single page of type in a situation, and even then might have to, with the initial printing, proofread it and find mistakes they had made, so they'd have to correct that. But imagine, at least over the course of time, if you had a 500 or 600 page Bible and it took you a day and a half to make it, you're talking about at least being able to produce 100 or 150 of those in a little more than a year. And that was the kind of thing that if you were writing it out by hand, by yourself, you would only have been able to do probably one a year. So it was something that At the time, you're beginning to have people think about having the Bible made available to people in their own native language. you begin to have the printing press also available that makes it to where books like we have were able to be produced in a way that made it much more easy for those to be acquired. Turn to the next one, please. There's just a page of the Gutenberg Bible. I think there are, I've forgotten. There's about 150 Wycliffe Bibles left. I'm not sure how many Gutenberg Bibles there are left. I saw that, but I've forgotten it. Okay, turn to the next one, please. Also about this time, something that's very important happens. You remember in about 1,000 years before 1453, it was in 476, Rome fell. And therefore, the west of the empire kind of fell into the Middle Ages, in the Dark Ages. In 1453, the Muslims take the city of Constantinople. And with that event, and just prior to it, you begin to have the Eastern Church try to get as many Greek manuscripts out of the East as possible. And the place where they sent them was to the west. Prior to this time, you didn't have very many Greek manuscripts that were circulating around in Italy and other places like that. At this particular time, you began to have Greek manuscripts, not only of Aristotle and Plato and others, but you began to have manuscripts of the New Testament that came out. And so it's therefore at this particular time that the translations in the vernacular, the printing press, the collapse of Constantinople spreading more Greek manuscripts out there make it to where it becomes much more easy for the Bible to be translated and to be able to be put into the hands of the average person. Thank you very much for your kind attention tonight, and we'll proceed on Sunday.